The Dunked On Basketball Podcast season preview series will continue today with my hometown team and the hometown team of the Golden State Warriors. Writer for ESPN, also has a fantastic True Hoop TV podcast with Amin El Hassan and their producer Jade Oy, who likes to start recording people when before they realize they're being recorded. Fortunately, I did not do that to Ethan today. What's up, man?
Oh, it's great. I like how I'm not going to have to do a lot. I'm going to be strictly ornamental since this is the team you watch more than any team. I figure you could just interview yourself while I take a nap.
I don't know how anybody does that, by the way. Just have a long conversation with yourself for a podcast for like 45 minutes.
It's a unique talent. I think it's a Jim Rome-esque talent. You just have to be forceful. You have to yell in a very theatrical way and just have strong takes. Look, if you don't think Steph Curry is going to get better, then I don't know what kind of basketball player you're watching, or that kind of thing. That's
so yeah. I mean, I sent you this whole outline, but you brought that up. How does he get better this year? Can he get better? You wrote about that a little bit, but for me, it seems like just small refinements of some of his existing skills, because there are no other huge skills that he can really add to his game at this point.
Yeah, I believe, the Warriors believe, that he will grow as a passer. He's already a fantastic passer if a bit reckless. Let's say he has a Brett Favre-type style, a gunslinger-type style, as a distributor. But the expectation is that with the influence of Steve Nash and just with his growth and his comfort in the offense, he is going to become a better point guard. One of the things that he's working on with his people from Accelerate is improving a lot of the finishes around the paint. That area, they want to get as creative as possible, as many different kinds of finishes as possible. And I never really thought of him as the most creative finisher around the basket, but when you break down his game, he's incredibly efficient down there for somebody who doesn't have a lot of the skills that make somebody a great finisher around the rim. So look out for him improving further at that.
Yeah, I'm sure that someone who had a much higher career turnover percentage than Steph did and Steve Nash should be really able to help him reduce his turnovers. Now, that's always... I got a lot of flack for saying that Steph last year had a better year than any year that Nash had. So I kind of think that's a little bit amusing. But, no, I think he'll really help him a lot. And, yeah, it's all kind of the small refinements, I guess, for Steph, maybe being more comfortable in this offense, getting a couple more quick backdoors, easy buckets.
I will say it was a little bit scary just how in the preseason game against Portland, he scored 30 points without really trying, just smoothly. Yes, it's preseason, but it made me think maybe we're in for an even bigger Steph Curry season. In fact, I think he's going to have
Who is he being guarded by again in that game?
Terrible defensive players.
CJ McCollum, yeah. And Damian Lillard. Yeah. Although I will say this, I only watched the highlights of that game, but it's not like he was making like really easy shots against them. But one of my theories is that when you're a bad defensive player, it becomes easier for guys to make tough shots on you because you don't make them uncomfortable at all. They have a predictability to taking this tough shot where even if you're nominally within range to challenge it, the guy knows that you're not going to be there. You're not going to surprise him with a hand in his vision taking a tough shot when he doesn't expect it.
Yeah, I believe that to be so, and I think that's something that we've seen, and confidence does play a role in success. It's one of the reasons why, and this is a tangent, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is talked about as this elite defensive player, and while he's very good and really an excellent defensive rebounder, I just wonder about somebody who doesn't force turnovers, and he doesn't force turnovers. Maybe he will when he eventually comes back from injury. I have no idea, but I think turnovers are important for creating that doubt. I think Andre Iguodala does a lot for himself because there's that fear since he's always doing that swipe down and he's always getting the strip. So there's that fear whenever you shoot it against him that you might lose the ball that way.
Yeah, and I think Kidd-Gilchrist is a really good underrated help defender. Actually, Mike Prada was talking about this on the Wizards podcast yesterday, but we also got into the MKG injury little bit. All right, well, let's get into sort of the rubric here, since we don't have fun on this podcast, no. Unlike yours.
No fun.
Usually where I like to start off with in trying to figure out what a team's going to do this year is to look at what they did last year, and that's especially pertinent here where they've had almost zero turnover. So how good was this team last year? There's talk now that maybe they got lucky. They didn't have to play Oklahoma City. They were injured. They didn't have to play the Spurs because they lost in the first round. They didn't have to play the Clippers because they lost in the second round. Kyrie was out. Kevin Love was out. But I think they were still pretty awesome last year nonetheless.
I would agree, and I think it says something about how many people didn't expect them to be this great that their accomplishment is dismissed on accord of them not having to play worse teams. I haven't really heard that one before. It's curious to me. And while you will also hear, hey, you need to get some luck to win it, I don't know how much luck this team needed. They didn't get to a seventh game in the playoffs. There wasn't a moment where a shot had to go down in order to save their season. At the same time, I can understand that perspective because while this team in the regular season was fantastic, they were a little bit, let's say, tight in the playoffs, which is understandable since they're young and this was the first time they had really pulled this off. So I don't think they were as impressive a playoff team as they were a regular season team, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I thought the Houston series, obviously they did everything they were expected to do in that series. If it hadn't been for that game four where I think they kind of mailed it in a little bit, they would have just swept Houston. The New Orleans series obviously was a sweep. And then just the fact they got down 2-1 against Memphis and the Cavaliers and looked pretty bad while doing so. I mean, I think in both of those series, you could argue that they were taken out of their game and what they really wanted to do. But then they came back and basically were not challenged in the last three games of both of those series. So and by the time Game 5 was over in both of those series, you felt like it was basically fait accompli. So, and then when you consider this is the best regular season team since the Jordan Bulls probably, they could be worse this year and I think still be the favorite.
I would agree. One interesting thing about their playoff performance is that while they did have these stumbles and these moments of doubt, there were also these moments where they solved the other team. And then at that juncture, you said that you felt by Game 5 that this series or these series were wrapped up. The interesting thing to me is that they felt that way. I remember after the Tony Allen decision, the decision to have Bogut guard Tony Allen, after that game, a Warriors player told me the series is over. It's no longer a series, and they're not going to win another game. And look, hey, he is so key to their defense. He is so key to their defense that now that we've made him completely unplayable offensively, that it's going to ruin their defense when he doesn't play. And it's just done. It's just done. And I thought that was maybe a little bit, I don't know, maybe a little bit too cocky. Who knows? But it was true. And there was also a moment like that with Ron Adams in the Cavs series where Ron Adams, stoic Ron Adams, told me, I believe with maybe two games to go in that particular series, I have no doubt that we're going to win. And that to me speaks to a pretty good team when they essentially know after they have solved the opposition that with this positive fatalism that it's just done.
Yeah, and now granted, they're playing against two teams in the Cavaliers and the Grizzlies that are pretty limited, especially offensively. So once the Warriors kind of figured out their one trick, there wasn't really much that they could do strategically to counter that when you're playing, and it's a fair criticism that, you know, those were teams that were good at what they were doing, but had no versatility to counter the Warriors' main strategic adjustments. I think this year they're going to be playing teams that have a lot more ability to adjust over the course of a playoff series.
I would agree, and I'm probably most intrigued to see how a team like Houston, that's very creative, might handle them in a playoff series. It's so cool how the Rockets, you can see the influence of analytics because if they're down, they start full court pressing and slinging even more threes. And I love how they fit what they do to the situation and to the risk reward of that. So in all likelihood, we will see series that are more of a chess match than we saw in the playoffs. But I do, for the most part, disagree with the Luck narrative, because I think the consensus at this point is that they got a lot of lucky breaks. And Luck is this interesting concept to me, because really, you can see it or not see it in almost anything. And for some reason, we have taken the view of injury as something that's wholly different, and that's just up to the gods. And I think what we do sometimes with the concept of luck is that we take something we can't quantify, or something that we're just starting to quantify, and ascribe it to the fates. And I don't think that's right. I think injuries are a probabilistic outcome, just like the game is a probabilistic outcome, just like you're trying to increase your probability of getting a good shot. And let's say Steph Curry has a wide open three. There's no guarantee he makes that three. Even if you've done everything to guarantee that you have a wide open three and you've done everything to increase your chances, you can't guarantee that it's going to go in. And it's the same with injury, where you can shift the odds in your favor. You can invest a whole bunch in your sports science department. You can chronicle and keep track of how players are expending energy on the floor and try to, have minute totals that will help.
You can just get younger players who have less of an injury.
Well, that too. And that's what's interesting about this whole concept of luck, where, yeah, I think the Cavs might have gotten unlucky, but if your core is built around Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving, and Iman Shumpert, you have chosen this life. You have a high-risk, high-reward situation. You have players who are injury-prone. So I don't know if it's luck or bad luck when – what's the cliche I'm looking for? The dice roll snake eyes? Some gambling term I don't know.
All right, so I agree with you there, but I can assure you that we are lucky to have you on the podcast.
That's
agree with that. Very little turnover for this team during the offseason, but they did make a few new acquisitions. How are those guys fitting in so far?
Not well. Not well. I thought we'd see more of them in the preseason. I thought we'd see in the battle for the 15th man that we would see more Ben Gordon out there. Jason Thompson looks like he is completely lost from the small moments I've seen him play basketball.
Well, so you were saying he was like hitting threes in practice the other day. I was there a couple days ago. His stroke doesn't look that smooth from three for me, and he wasn't hitting quite as many, I think, maybe as he was when you saw him. I don't think that him really shooting three-pointers is necessarily going to be a weapon this year.
I think baby steps. It's cool that he was making those in practice, and it's impressive, but he just needs to know where to be. He needs to know where to go. He needs to be able to roll to the basket off pick and roll instead of popping, for the most part anyway. And it was clear that there is enough corporate knowledge, as the Spurs say, that it's hard to catch up, especially as a role player. And those bench units looked a little chaotic in the first two preseason games.
Before we go on, though, I think it's worth talking about maybe the biggest off-court issue with this team. We did a mock rookie extensions podcast trying to find extensions for Barnes and Azili. How are the negotiations there going right now? Let's start with Barnes.
I believe at this juncture, probably pretty stalled. I know I've talked to people who say once he changed agents, once he fired his agent and went with Schwartz, that's probably a signal that it's not going to get done by the 31st. Something could always happen there. The thing that I'm interested in is how the preseason might influence negotiations, where maybe for Barnes, it's a good idea in the abstract to try to get this insane contract and try to get, I don't know, I don't know whatever exact figure he's looking for, but to try to really push it. But it's another
more than 4 years, 64 million.
Yeah, more than 4 and 64, and that's a good idea in theory. But then once the preseason starts and your teammates are ragging on you about the money, and maybe there's a little resentment right there, and you're not playing especially well, as he hasn't in these two games. He has not looked good at all.
Although in fairness, they've talked about how he was killing it in the preseason scrimmages, although they always seem to say that about him.
Yeah, he's a classic. They're always talking about that. He's not exactly doing what Klay Thompson did last preseason, where you could see the growth, and you could see that Klay was about to have a killer year, and that put the onus on the Warriors to get something done. So far, he's not putting the onus on them. So I think some leverage has shifted back to Golden State. And one of the complicated things when you say where are the negotiations, Golden State is hard to track in that regard because they have something of a democracy, a high security council. And I don't know if everybody in that is united in how they feel about Harrison. I think there are people in there who are more pro-Harrison, and people are saying, no, no way, we don't pay him. We don't pay him that amount.
Yeah, anything that you're going to pay him, even that 4-for-64 offer, which apparently, you know, I assume if it gets done, it's going to be above that now because that was already rejected and it was pretty early on. It's all based on his growth potential, right?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone will agree, even with the new cap, he is not that level of player. That is above average starter money, even under the new cap, and he is not at that point yet by any means. And really, he probably should not be a starter on this team, but because they want to preserve Iguodala and, you know, kind of prop Barnes up, that Iguodala comes off the bench. But as of now, Iguodala is still better than him.
True. Iguodala is better than him. Really, Iguodala is somebody who takes care of his body and invests in trying to preserve himself. So I don't necessarily buy the idea that there's going to be some massive fall off where you're going to need Harrison to step in and take over that role in the next year or two. So that also shifts some leverage to the Warriors. And one second, can we have an edit point right here?
Yeah.
Allie, are you about to fry bacon?
Yeah.
Do you think there's going to be a lot of – well, I guess we can see how much ambient noise is there when the bacon is fried. I'm seeing if I should shift.
It'll be fine. Don't worry.
It'll be fine? Okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Hey, what's up?
Not.
I already know the answer to that question. You're cooking
bacon.
Yeah,
you're cooking bacon.
That's true.
The noisiest food. How dare you? Okay, so I don't know where I was on that. What was I talking about?
Bacon, I think.
Bacon, I was talking about bacon. Will Harrison Barnes bring home the bacon? I almost sounded like...
Oh, no, you're saying Andre takes care of his body.
Yeah.
He's better than Barnes.
He's better than Barnes, yeah. Andre takes care of his body. He is better than Barnes. So I almost wonder if the leverage is going to shift back if Barnes has a really bad preseason to the point where he takes less than 64. But at this point, and I probably had a bunch of conflicting predictions and projections, my best guess would be that they don't get a deal done by the 31st and they just play it out.
He won't take less than 64 because they're not going to pull an offer that they already made. That's not something that you can really do in negotiations. Like, that just really angers people. And unless there's been some enormous change in the leverage, I mean, just because he plays a little worse in the preseason, it's just not really something you could do. I mean, you look at, like, the Cavs and Tristan Thompson, that 5-for-80 is still on the table, even though a lot of his leverage is gone now because he can't accept the qualifying offer. Granted, he's got LeBron involved as well, and they need him for this year. Barnes is under contract this year, but it's really rare to see a team just pull an offer like that, unless it's in the chaos of free agency where you have a huge opportunity cost, like, in the next 24 hours.
True, but I think what often happens, depending on what agent you have, depending on what team you have, there's an element of take this now. There's an element of take this now, but it could be a moving target. You know, like, we could do this number now, but this is the only time we're going to offer this number. And I certainly know of agents who operate that way, but maybe as a team you can't operate that way because you will anger the player. But I also think, and I said that the expectation is that he should get paid an enormous sum just because there's so much money flooding in. I felt silly for saying that just watching him, and that could be an overreaction in the first two games. He has not looked good. Not look good.
Well, and there's so what's been so bad about him in the first couple games?
Just looking shaky, uncertain, not getting involved in the offense, not looking particularly good defensively. That you just don't see improvement too. That shot fake is still super slow. The footwork still needs work. And maybe I'm too influenced by moments like that airballed wide open 3-pointer, but it's hard to watch that and think $20 million.
Well, and if he really does have this somewhat fragile psyche that at least, I don't know whether he does or doesn't, but some people seem to think that these negotiations could kind of be wearing on him and negatively affecting his performance. And you say, all right, you know, the cap's going up so much, they got to pay him. They're still, especially for a team that's this good, this isn't like, you know, you're the Orlando Magic and you're probably not going to be a huge free agent destination. They have a huge opportunity cost. If they sign him in 2017, they theoretically could get close to max space. So every dollar that they spend on him is something that they can't use in 2017. They definitely have plenty of incentive to try and squeeze him absolutely as much as they can.
This is true. And again, I think the preseason is a reminder that they could survive without him. They could be a good team even if they lose him for nothing. I know general managers hate doing that, but it wouldn't necessarily be the end of the world. So we will see. We will see. It looks like a standoff for now, albeit a cordial standoff, but it's something that I believe could be shifted by the experience of playing. The thing I don't expect him, even for a season, to be the highest paid Warrior. That's my prediction on this podcast.
Well, wouldn't he be that if they did the 4 for 64? I think it'd be pretty close. I have to look at the math.
I think
Clay
would edge him out. Let's see this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's. Dun, 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 dun. This is podcast interneting. It's not the best radio in the world.
Well, here, I'll talk while you do that. So the other issue for the Golden State, though, is if Barnes plays really well, and maybe even if he doesn't, their downside is he could be making $22 million instead of something that they can control.
True.
The summer of 2017. And so one thing that they might be able to do here, which I would do if I were them, is start him pretty high next year when you're probably not going to be a player.
So Clay would be making 16-6 next season.
Yeah.
So okay. I don't expect.
Yeah. So yeah, he would probably be ahead of that unless they choose to start him higher next season and then bring him down for 2017 to just give themselves a little bit more operating room.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's ultimately Barnes is seems like kind of a businessman. He's aggressive. But on the other hand, every one of these extensions so far has probably come in lower than we would have thought that it would, because ultimately there is performance risk downside, there's injury risk downside, and with the cap being so high, even whatever he ends up getting, even if it's less than he theoretically wants, is still absolute life-changing, set-for-life money, and that, you know, it all depends on your mentality, right? Is it, do you want to have a 100% chance at $64 million, or do you want to have an 80% chance at $90 million and a 20% chance at $40
million? There is that term that agents use when talking to players who want the best possible deal, which is pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. And in trying to pursue the best possible contract and forcing a team to bend your will in the way that Tristan Thompson is doing, the way Harrison Barnes might do, you never know what could happen. You never know if you're going to have some terrible injury or some other circumstance is going to swipe the check out of your hand. So I think that's why we're seeing players take a contract that's a great contract, but maybe not their maximum value.
What's your prediction for what happens here? Do you think they can get to a number? And if so, what is it?
I think my prediction is a divorce at a certain point.
Really? So a divorce in the sense that, like, they don't match something in restricted free agency, or maybe they sign him and try to move on from him in the summer of 2017 to open up more space?
Well, that's the one I can't predict. My prediction, and it's always a changing prediction, so it's very meaningless to your listeners, but my prediction is that they don't get something done by the 31st, and then that means that they eventually part ways. Now, the way they do that, I can't predict, whether it's trading him somehow or just seeing him leave for nothing, but that's my projection, with the caveat that this preseason might change the dynamics of the negotiation.
What do you think he would take?
I think he would take eventually the exact figure, the floor of the negotiations right now. That's what made the
So you're predicting that they are actually going to reduce their offer from that?
Well, not that they're going to and reduce therefore it, won't get but maybe stick with the offer that was leaked, and that's going to be the basis of the negotiations. And that's just my guess that's kind of the take it or leave it figure, and they're not going to go wildly above that. And if Harrison's not willing to do that, then it's going to lead to a parting of ways between the two sides. And these are guesses. These are absolute guesses by me, because there's been so much turbulence with him firing his agent because he was trying to squeeze his agent, which, by the way, is, I'm not sure ethically the best thing to do. Not to feel sympathetic towards agents, which, you know, rarely happens, but just a bizarre way to negotiate your business. It's something where it's fine if you want to go with a commission that's lower and you want to force that from your agent, but doing it at the last minute is just very strange.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. The last minute part I hadn't considered. I mean, if it's business and you're trying to get the best deal for yourself, I think it's basically all is kind of fair.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you're not really like doing something morally objectionable, which I wouldn't put in that category. All right, how about Azealy? How's he looking so far in the preseason to start with?
He looks okay. You know, he got swept up in a lot of the bench looking awful against Portland. That was an interesting game just because the defensive effort from everybody was terrible. And it made me think that maybe this team is going to be better offensively than they are defensively, just because.
Yeah, that occurred to me too. And I think that's where you would normally see the drop off. A team like the 0-1 Lakers is a perfect example.
Oh, they're 21st in defense?
They were terrible. Yeah, they were terrible defensively that year after having a massive improvement. That's where most of their improvement came that first year under Phil Jackson. And then, of course, they turned it up in that 0-1 playoffs and had one of the greatest playoff runs ever. The counter to that, though, is all this they were lucky talk. Everyone is the West is going to be so good now. Everyone's healthy again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe that will increase the motivation. On the other hand, you do sort of get this feeling that this is such a confident group now that they will get to the point potentially where they feel like they can just turn it on.
Yeah, I think that's the expectation. And it was funny. I don't think the coaches knew quite how to handle what happened in that preseason game, because it's hard to know when a preseason effort from a confident team that's capable of winning a championship means anything. You can say
yeah,
that,
and I mean the Blazers put up like, and now I do. I actually think that Blazers team is going to be pretty good.
Oh, they're fun, man. They're at the very
but
least.
But they put up like 75 on them in the first half.
Yeah, and you could just visually see that they were going through the motions with that lock and trail style of defense and pick and roll that the Warriors do. Curry was not exactly going hard, and when you're not going hard in lock and trail, defense looks so perfunctory and just so lazy at that point. You're just kind of jogging behind the guy as he's whipping around the screen.
So, yeah, so you said Azealy didn't really look that great. Overall, I mean, what's kind of the buzz out of camp about how he's been so far?
Well, nobody's saying that he is a remade player and he's totally different and he has added a hook shot three-pointer. I think there's just more excitement for how he has finally had an offseason where he's fully trained. He hasn't had that in the NBA, just a healthy
yeah.
offseason of training. So there's excitement for what he'll be able to do once he comes back, and maybe we'll see him play more than what we perhaps expected with how Jason Thompson has been struggling to get the system. So maybe he's not going to be that much of a threat to Azealy's minutes.
Yeah, and Spates also, talk was he was going to come back lighter. I did not see that from him when I saw that preseason game in person last Monday. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, which is funny because I've heard the same things about how he's lighter, and Jaron Collins, the Warriors assistant coach, was telling me that Mo is lighter, and I was saying, Jaron, you look lighter. You look like you lost weight in the offseason. I don't necessarily see it from Mo, but maybe it's just imperceptible. In any event, he looks like Mo Spates, who has grown into a nice role player, who's grown into a quality backup, which is not something I necessarily would have expected when he came to the Warriors.
Yeah, but the reason we talk about all this is his competition at backup center, Azealy's, that is, mm-hmm. is very important for this year, right? If Thompson and Spates get more minutes than him, which is not completely out of the realm of possibility. And that's something that has to be considered in the negotiation, because if he's the fourth string center on this team, he's not going to look nearly as good in restricted free agency as if he's the backup and kind of heir apparent to Bogut, who will only have 1 year left on his contract after that. So that's all with that range of possibilities and the uncertainty also with the fact that he's been injured. I think they have a little better chance of getting into a deal with him than they do with Barnes, perhaps. Do you see it that way?
I would see it that way, and certainly he's going to command less money than Barnes is. He's a player that I'm a bigger fan of than you are. I'm more of an Azili booster, I believe. I like the size and the athleticism and just the style that the team adopts when he is in the center position. It's a different look than the Bogut look. They're more forceful, it feels. They can run the floor a bit better. They can get those dunks off pick and roll a little bit easier, I think. And it's just a different look. It's a totally different look. The Bogut look is great. He deserves to be starting center with all those dribble handoffs. Azili cannot do that. That's not in his skill set. He's not exactly Magic Johnson with the passing.
He's not going to hit guys backdoor the way Bogut does.
Yeah, or just pass to them.
he's not as good of a screener as Bogut either. I think that's a big thing to consider as well.
True. That's definitely true. But he is more athletic, and there's some potential there for that different look that I quite enjoy, at least aesthetically. But I do think that he is projected as a future starting center and somebody where if Bogut breaks down, you could see him eventually taking over. I'm not sure you feel that way necessarily, but I feel that way. I think he could be.
I mean, I see the same upside that you see. I think I just believe there's a lower percentage chance that he actually realizes it. I think there are some very solid reasons to doubt him still after, 20 games of being able to catch the ball.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I understand your fears, even though I believe I mostly chalk them up to you being a self-hating big man who is overly critical of big men. But I can respectfully understand your perspective.
So what do you think? We haven't heard anything, no leaks on kind of what the figures are with them. I mean, where do you think this one might end up? What are your general impressions, predictions? What do you think will happen here?
Well, Festus is really more go along, get along. So let's just predict that it gets done before the 31st, and I'll just toss out a figure, maybe 11 or 12 a year. That's just pulled out of the sky / something I probably can't say on your podcast.
No, I don't have any big brother. You can say whatever you want. I mean, I think kind of 9 to 12 is the range, 9 to 12 a year for 4 years. I think it needs to be – I don't see that there's any way, even if he has the best possible year this year, that he gets more than $15 million. I don't think that he ever – can become more than an average starting center just due to his offensive limitations. He has great defensive tools. I'm not sure that his awareness is quite at the level of some of the great centers, maybe someone like Bogut.
Yeah.
So I think that the downside risk is not that bad if they let him go into restricted free agency. So if I'm the Warriors, I'm only signing him to a contract where if he realizes his upside, we can say to ourselves, yeah, this is a really good contract. And that's, once you get above 12, you're probably not there. I mean, what is the most that you would offer him?
That's a fascinating question because a lot of that influences what you think about the Barnes decision and the Kevin Durant call to pipe dream. I don't know what. So it's difficult for me. I can say where I would go with it, but it would be in a vacuum without those other considerations. So maybe around 14, maybe 14, maybe even 15. Again, yeah. I'm a big Azili booster.
So you think if you're going to pay him 15 now, mm-hmm. that means you believe he could get more next year in restricted free agency.
Oh, he definitely could get more. If Bogut goes down and he fills in that role and he's as productive as he was on a per-minute basis as he was last season, and maybe even a little bit better, I mean, he's going to get a lot more than that. So There's definitely.
Wow. Okay. I disagree with you on that. I think even, you know, when I think of average money for a starter being $15 million, I just don't think there's any way he looks like better than an average starter. And you also consider, too, it's not like this is a guy who's 23 coming off his rookie contract. But he's going to be 26. So
he's going to be 26.
You have to consider he's about what he's going to be at this
point. He's going to be 26, but he's a big athletic center. And those guys get paid. So I wouldn't be shocked if he got in excess of that if he plays out this season, has a great season. That wouldn't surprise me. And again, I'm a bigger Azeeley believer than you are. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong to be that. We just have to see.
Yeah, I mean, his stats last year, if you look at him, are pretty good. I mean, he had a higher usage than I would have expected, 18%. Mm-hmm. You know, with 20% being average, turns it over quite a bit. But 6.2% block percentage, which 2-point block percentage, which is fantastic. 13% offensive rebound percentage, which is an aspect that he provides that Bogut really kind of doesn't that well in at this point in his career. And 16.2 PR and 58% true shooting. So that's all. And 56% free throw rate as well. And he's not a horrible free thrower either. So, yeah, maybe there is, just when you look at his box score line, yeah, that is like starting center material. But again, I think that his offensive limitations and his feel limitations are somewhat anathema to the way that this team plays. When you have Luke Walton talking about, we want to get to another level and out IQ people. But the last thing I'll say on that is, Bogut's contract expires in the summer of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
You want to try and get a really good free agent, and you know, some of the best guys are not really centers. I don't think the center crop is that great during that. And you know, throwing it into the post to a guy is not really how they want to play anyway. So if you can get Azeeley locked down, take the chance that he can be your starting center for what's hopefully a below market value. And then you free up that ability to go and sign someone on the wing, another scorer or something, maybe someone even to replace Harrison Barnes if they want to move on from him. So having that center position locked up reasonably well, it would be huge, because otherwise if you don't have him, then you're going to need to get a center, and you're now can't really go after any luxury items in free agency either.
True. That's completely true, and that's why it would be so beneficial to get him locked in, for a variety of reasons, including that they do like to build from within. They do like to grow organically in that way. And also, as an aside, he's very popular in the locker room. He seems to be beloved by his teammates, for whatever that's worth.
Oh, but he was rooting against them all of the year that he sat up. What are you talking about? How was he ever able to recover from that?
Man, it took a lot for him to do damage control there for the sin of secretly rooting against your teammates while injured that he was accused of by the Jackson regime. But somehow he has bounced back. Maybe he hired an internal PR firm to convince his teammates that he's actually a good guy, and they seem to love him and pull for him. And I remember Draymond Green in the Memphis series, I think, credited Festus for helping them win a game. It was the one where he asked himself the question. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I do remember that. Yeah.
So he asked himself a question just to praise.
Right? Yeah, I think that was game four. Right?
Yeah, and when Bogut went down with an injury, I know that we have somehow scrubbed the history and made it seem as though the Warriors, everybody played every game and nobody was injured all season, and it was the most amazing run of, it was the Joe DiMaggio of hits run of luck. But Bogut went down with an injury for, I think, a month last season, yeah. And at the beginning of it, I was surprised that the players were kind of lightly regarding that injury, and Steph Curry was adamant that Festus will step in and kill it. So he is very popular with his teammates, who have a lot of belief in him, even if they give him a lot of shit for not passing the ball and for being, as they call him, Swagzeeley, who thinks that everything should be turned into a right-handed hook shot off the bank.
In fairness, he was at least, I saw him working on some right shoulder moves at practice the other day. But let's get into.
Well, I just want to say one thing about that. I'm afraid for Theo Robertson, who formerly played for Cal, played basketball for Cal. who is doing a lot of these drills with Festus, because Festus swings those elbows like crazy, and poor Theo is around, I think, 6'5", and it's just at face level. So that's, I just want to say a prayer out to the gods right now that poor Theo is going to keep his face, but continue.
You can't get this kind of insider knowledge anywhere else. All right, so now we know this is a fantastic team last year. Who is likely to improve on this team that could maybe theoretically even make them better, maybe not in the regular season, but by playoff time?
I'm going to say Steph Curry as my candidate for improvement, which is funny because we were asking each other over the summer, how can this guy possibly improve? And we talked about it a little earlier in the podcast, but he just seems like he will be able to take it another level. So that would be my best guess for improvement. My second candidate would be the formerly talked about Festus. Third candidate, I believe, would be Draymond Green, just because he seems to be good at that whole improving thing. Maybe Clay fourth. And am I missing anybody on this age curve? I Harrison Barnes, I guess you would have to mention, but again, I'm just worried based on what I've seen.
Yeah, but I think by mentioning so many people, you really get to the crux of the matter, which is maybe not all these guys will improve, but these are almost all their core players that you just mentioned, and they are all young enough.
McAdoo, another candidate for improvement. That's somebody who's been getting praised a lot. I liked how the look against the Raptors in the preseason game when they had Festus and McAdoo on the court at the same time, which kills your offensive spacing, but they were just so vicious at the rim on defense. And I think McAdoo is somebody who, a breakout season for McAdoo is just becoming a rotation player, but I think he could do that.
Yeah, and there's, maybe you could even say Sean Livingston might add a three-pointer. You know, he might get more comfortable in the offense. And, you know, you look at Iguodala and Bogut as regression candidates. Those are the two that really stick out. With Bogut being now 31, Iguodala is going to turn 32, I think, during the season. But
Iguodala went to Germany, though.
that's true. And Bogut lost 20 pounds. He looks thinner, although I didn't particularly see that he looked that much faster in the one game that I've seen so far. But maybe at least there's good hope that those guys can stave off the decline that their ages might indicate. But yeah, maybe not all these guys get better, but some of them are going to, I think, almost certainly. And Steph, it's quite possible last year was the best year of his career, his age 26, 27 season. But he's not a guy who's really that dependent on athleticism, and certainly a guy who works on his skills really well. And, you know, if he just takes a lot more contested three-pointers and hits them, I mean, he was making ridiculous shots, obviously, in that Blazers game. I expect that he'll be even more unguardable.
The interesting thing about the Blazers game is I don't think he was hitting shots that were that ridiculous. He had one that was very impressive. I think it was off a deflection where he just reset his body from looking at the sideline to having perfect balance and facing the rim and just lofting it over. I think it was Myers Leonard. So that was good, but it just seemed like it was easy and coming in the flow, and that he might get better at getting around the rim and finishing around the rim. So I think in that way, the points could come even a little bit more easily, because the thing about as he gets better, as he's increasingly feared around the league, and nobody is quite feared as he is around the three-point line, that's more leverage to get to the cup.
Yeah, you make a good point there. And one thing I will say, this isn't necessarily as it relates to individual improvement, but we talked about the defense maybe regressing. I think not having Coach Kerr around during training camp, that's something that might contribute to that a little bit, especially early on.
That is the big concern I have with this team as far as will they be better than last year that doesn't seem to be talked about. It seems like we don't value coaching because perhaps it's not that tangible. But to me, that's the biggest concern on my mind with this team is, are they going to be a bit discombobulated with Kerr not involved? And is he going to continue to suffer health issues throughout the season? I have no idea there. And that could potentially be disrupted because Steve Kerr is really good at his job.
Yeah, and I think with Alvin Gentry being gone, I mean, Alvin obviously is not exactly like a stern type. Luke Walton certainly is not that either. And, you know, I think it's kind of the idea, and Rod Adams is kind of more of the defensive technician. But I do think that this team needs the fire and passion from Kerr from an emotional standpoint,
yes,
that he provides. And maybe there might be not quite enough seriousness in training camp, because, you know, Luke Walton is a 34-year-old coach who'd never been a head coach before. You know, certainly a very smart guy, very qualified. But I think one of the big things that makes Kerr so good is he's just so emotionally intelligent. I mean, he's got to be one of the most emotionally intelligent guys you can ever think of or have ever met. I mean, the way he handles the media, his team, and I think he just had a great understanding of what his team needed from an emotional standpoint. And now I kind of sound like a talking head a little bit. Yeah, I don't
know.
No,
because this stuff is true.
But it's true.
There are cliches that are true. And what's interesting is that even though Kerr is not the coach who is tough guy coach and makes the team run for no reason and has all the bromides that perhaps Byron Scott does when he talks about basketball, there are those moments. I think Kerr has said, sometimes you have to yell at a guy, get your fucking ass in gear. And maybe they lose that, and maybe that's important.
All right. From an overrated, kind of underrated standpoint, this is a team that's been in the national eye. Who is kind of better than you think on this team, and who might be a little overrated?
I think Steph, as crazy as it sounds, because he won MVP and because he had the best-selling jersey and he had the most second best-selling jersey maybe and the most All-Star votes, in a way, I think there's still a disbelief about how good he is and a lack of understanding of what his impact is. I thought it was,
yeah, you and I both agree he should have won Finals MVP.
Yeah, right? And we're heavily in the minority on that opinion. Well, this is an aside. I thought LeBron's Finals was pretty overrated. And I know that sounds dismissive. I understand why it happened. I understand why the strategy was to put the ball in his hands.
They scored 93 points per 100 possessions in that series.
Yeah.
Like, even, and he wasn't efficient by himself either. So, and granted, they're playing a great defense, but that was a defense that gave up like 99 points per 100 possessions and was number one during the regular season. So, the Cavaliers scored at a 6 points worse per 100 possessions than the Warriors' average opponent during the regular season.
Yeah, and they would have been, of course, even worse without him, and were worse in the brief moments he sat, but it doesn't change the fact that he was so inefficient and that the big numbers were deceiving in that way. He missed nearly, I think, 200 shots in that series in those six games. And so,
wait, hold on. No, that's not possible.
Wait, maybe
he
I said
miss,
maybe
he didn't miss over 30 shots per game.
Wait, I think I meant 100. I think in my mind, though, he missed nearly 200 shots. And that's
yeah, 100 shots might be like a little bit.
I don't know why it's
20 a game. It seems a little more realistic.
I don't know,
which is still an astronomical number.
Yeah, that's still quite a few shots. That's something. Maybe I'll look that up right now. NBA Finals.
But yeah, I agree with you that Steph is a little bit underrated, and that's because people just don't realize the effect that he has, right?
Yeah.
And when they went small, that's why it was so effective, was because he was on the court. He creates an instant double team 35 feet from the hoop, and then he throws it to Draymond Green, and Draymond Green has a 4-on-3, and you can just do that on every single possession.
Yeah.
And it's just... it's ridiculous. And so many of their – and Klay Thompson did absolutely nothing in that series. And I don't think he deserved to be killed for that, because the Cavs' scheme was basically do not come off him for any reason.
The Warriors got the benefit of playing 4-on-4, which is advantageous to the offense. At the same time, Iman Shumpert did a great job on Klay and shut him down anyways.
Yeah, and Klay, I mean, who knows? He was coming back from that concussion, too. He may not have quite been – 100% either, but yeah, I mean, they won that series easily without Klay really doing much except offense.
So here's why I misspoke. LeBron took nearly 200 shots in those six games. He missed 118. He missed 118 of them.
Yeah, so that's 20. He missed 20 shots per game, basically, which is Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. All right, what about someone who might be a little overrated on this squad?
It might be Klay. And I enjoy the hell out of Klay Thompson, and he's a very good basketball player, and he's somebody who has potential for improvement going forward. But because there's a nickname like the Splash Brothers, because they're the, quote, best backcourt in the league, then that can make you assume that Klay and Steph are on the same level, and that's just not the case.
Well, also, you have to consider, too, that he, I don't think he was as good after the All-Star break. And obviously, that 37 points in a quarter was pretty massive. He started the All-Star game, which is probably, you know, he's not as good of a player as James Harden. Like, yeah. He shouldn't have started the All-Star game, other than the fact that Steve Kerr is really emotionally intelligent and decided to start his own player.
Mm.
And also, you know, if you're actually trying to win the basketball game, which Steve Kerr specifically said he wasn't.
Yes.
So I'm just going to stop talking about that. Yeah, I think Klay. And maybe after this year, it'll be Barnes. And you know, I'm going to
say Barnes is up there too. You know, you're about to have a hot take. I'm sorry, I stepped on it. Please.
I think Iguodala might be a little bit after the Finals MVP performance, which he was great. Don't get me wrong, but I don't think what he was able to do offensively.
Yeah.
All of that was because of Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, where he was being guarded by Timofey Mozgov. Most of the time, he was basically playing 3-on-2 every time he caught the ball.
True.
And, you know, so he did great defensively, but, you know, overall, I think he is not quite the individual stopper that he might have looked like against LeBron, who just, his only move in that series was to just lower his shoulder into his chest over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Iguodala is a great player, but I do think, especially over the course of a regular season, that he can really go through some offensive droughts and shooting droughts that people may underrate a little bit.
I completely agree with you. Even though he has this responsibility of being the leader of the bench, he's the patron saint of the bench. It's almost like a management position because he's the guy who is the organizer, the on-court organizer of that second unit, and that's an important role. But I agree with everything you said, and I thought that Steph got robbed for Finals MVP. And it's very intellectually inconsistent to vote Iguodala Finals MVP and at the same for his great defense on LeBron and at the same time be giving LeBron votes for Finals MVP. It doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense.
No, I guess not. Well, I'm sure every single person either thought LeBron had a terrible series and voted for Iguodala, or thought LeBron had a great series and didn't vote for Iguodala, right?
I guess that's the
since we're so intellectually consistent.
I guess that's the only way it can really make sense. I was surprised. You know, Curry wasn't scoring at the rate that he.
He only really had the one bad game in Game 2. If he has a good game in that game, I think he probably would
have
ended up.
It's that people think that little of Matthew Dellavedova.
Yeah, and he shot 5 of 23, and then there was, oh, Delly is shutting him down and all that. I mean, I guess, you know, now that David Lee is gone, we can't really, you know, kick the obvious overrated. All right, playing time battles. We talked about backup center already. I think that's really enough. How about, like, the Barnes-Iguodala thing? I mean, that's – and then I guess backup shooting guard. Those would be the other two that show up to me.
One second. There's coffee grinding in the background.
Just keep talking.
Just keep talking. No, but I didn't hear. I got distracted. It was one of those funny things where I figured that the coffee wasn't going to be disruptive, and it wasn't. But it was only disruptive because I was focusing on it. So it's really my fault. It's not your fault, Allie. I love you.
I was trying to be really quiet.
It's not your fault.
you put the coffee grinder on quiet setting.
I asked him if it was okay.
I nodded my head, and then it totally ruined me.
Don't worry about it. It just adds color.
So the question you asked was what?
The question is potential playing time issues. I pointed to backup shooting guard and maybe also on the wing, kind of for the crunch time lineup between Barnes and Iguodala, or whether you're going to go small with Green at center and take Bogut out.
I don't expect him to go small with Green a tremendous amount. I think that's a break glass in case of emergency lineup, as cool as it is. I don't expect that to become the new normal just in certain situations. I do think their strongest closing lineup is the one where Andre is in place of Harrison. So I would expect to see that when they really, 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 really need to win a game. So And it's so hard to project as far as what the bench is going to be. They have so many different kinds of looks at their disposal. Spates at center is a different look than Azeli at center. Livingston can be plugged in a variety of ways, and it's kind of fun when he plays alongside Steph. So I guess I'm giving you a very vague answer that there are just a lot of different looks and options, and I'm not sure how it's going to shake out.
Backup shooting guard is something that we've talked about a lot.
Your boy Barbosa, your favorite.
Yeah. Well, so he, I mean, if you look, again, another guy, if you look at his box score stats, 15.6 PR last year, but was one of the worst defenders in the league by plus-minus metrics. And this is one of those times where, you know, sometimes the plus-minus metrics just show up as bad and you can't articulate why. I think I can very easily articulate why. And it's not even that he's so terrible individually. I mean, he'll lose his man. He's not amazing. Putting him on James Harden in the Western Conference Finals at times was a joke. But the bigger issue is having him invalidates a lot of their strategy, because they're switching from 2 to 4 mm-hmm. is such a powerful weapon, and they can't really do that when he's in the game. I like playing Livingston more as a backup center. Granted, with his injury history, you don't want to overplay him during the regular season. But I thought Barbosa was someone who probably really shouldn't not be playing that much, especially by the time the playoffs are
over. And I wonder, I mean, he got $2 million for the season, so I think his spot is secure, but I wonder if that played into getting Ben Gordon into camp, because Ben Gordon, even though he is short for an NBA player, does have some length. What's his wingspan? Something like 6'9", I think?
Well, Ben Gordon?
Yeah.
Nah, I think it's actually pretty low. I'll look it up. Yeah, so your closing lineup then is just Iguodala, the starters, but Iguodala is in for Barnes.
Yes, unless you're going against a team that you can run off the floor and then go with the Draymond of the five look. Wingspan for Ben Gordon is 6'8.5".
Oh, all right, fair enough.
And height?
Yeah, you're one of these much better at talking and looking stuff up people than I am. I guess you're a more veteran podcaster.
Well, it's just that the Draft Express for me pops up in my Google, because Draft Express is something that I look a lot at. So yeah, those would be my crunch.
Yeah, you can't find out what someone is in socks rather than shoes.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal for me. I want to say about Barbosa though, it seems like his role on the team is more emotional than anything else, and he is one of those magically great teammates and somebody that Kerr trusts to extend his message to the team. So that perhaps is why he gets more of a role on the floor than he would seem to warrant. I do think that he got better defensively as the year went along, and I think he was awful, and then after a lot of work with Ron Adams, and Barbosa told me, you know, nobody had ever really even asked me to play defense up until this point. this is the first time that it's actually happened, and I wonder how Barbosa feels about bringing in Ben Gordon. I don't know if Ben Gordon's going to make the team. I don't think he should, frankly. You know, for a variety of reasons.
Who do you think that last guy should be?
I think Ian Clark. That's a question I'm asking a lot of. Lot.
Someone that you can at least develop a little bit. Maybe he's got a little bit more in terms of point guard skills than Gordon. I just don't think Gordon has anything left, frankly.
Well, that's not even the reason that I wouldn't. The reason that I wouldn't with Gordon is just he has been a bit of a malcontent reputationally at some of his spots. And it seems like Andre definitely wants him on the team and in his corner, and was talking as though he was already in the rotation at Media Day. And Andre, for all his great qualities, and for even he's unselfish as a player, and he's very intelligent, he can be kind of a locker room lawyer a little bit. And I'm not sure that you necessarily want an entire Iguodala contingent in the locker room. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, fair enough. We usually talk about strengths and weaknesses. I think everyone knows what the strengths of this team are. But what are the weaknesses? How are you going to try to attack this team if you're an opponent? You're one of the better teams in the West.
That's a great question. I think the way the Spurs were doing it with great perimeter defense and then eventually putting Kawhi onto Steph Curry, trying to fatigue the Warriors by having somebody pressure them full court, having a backup like Corey Joseph just hound Curry in the full court and expending that energy, because that guy isn't going to play more than 16 minutes so he can just go full bore. That was a pretty good strategy. It's odd.
Yeah, they don't have anyone like that.
It's weird. Yeah. I thought the Spurs had a lot of elements to give the Warriors trouble, and then they went in this other direction, and they're such a smart team that I don't want to reflexively doubt them. But when I hear things like we're going with LaMarcus Aldridge because the Warriors have gone small, so we want to beat them up and go big, and that's a consideration. Dude, I've seen Draymond guard LaMarcus. I don't know if that's something that makes the Warriors shake in their boots. I thought they had a pretty good thing going. They had a good thing going before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of this as a team. I think that if you have a real big post-up behemoth,
mm-hmm.
And they can be attacked on the offensive boards, I think that Bogut, for his smarts, for the fact that he is a tough guy generally, half the games he kind of disappears, especially in the playoffs.
If
right?
he's I mean, going if against a bigger player, he seems to lose an edge.
He had to be taken. I mean, he had to be taken out of the rotation. Like the part of the reason that switch to Draymond at center worked so well is because Bogut was terrible the first three games.
Yes, and he has been especially bad specifically against Mozgov, not just in that series, but before it, where...
Yeah, the 93 points and 29 rebounds game when there was a typo, but I think he had like 23 and 29 when he was on the Nuggets.
Yeah, he got dominated, and I think that it's hard for Bogut to know what to be and how to be it when going against somebody of just the sheer size of Mozgov. So, yeah, in certain situations that can happen.
Yeah, so that would be one, and I think also he didn't play well in those first three games of the Memphis series either. And my big thing about that series was that just he and Draymond needed to play better, and they really turned it around, aided by the fact that he was guarding Tony Allen. That helped a lot too. So yeah, I think that's one way to attack them. I think defensively, just making Draymond Green beat you one on one. But the problem is, you can't switch anybody onto Steph. I mean, he is one of the rare perimeter players that you just cannot switch onto because it's going to be a three or it's going to be getting right to the
rim. Only guy, and we'll see how they deploy it. It'll be interesting to see how they deploy it. Hey, in the first game, you get to see how they deploy it. The only guy who's really had success as a big when switched out on Steph Curry is Anthony Davis. He's really the only one.
That's right. Yeah, he actually did a really nice job in that New Orleans series on him.
He did. It killed their rebounding in many ways. You know,
yeah, and he was just completely exhausted by the end of every game, too.
Yeah, and that's a big reason why Draymond was able to guard him so well at the end of those games is that he was less worn down. You could see it, that he just didn't have the burst. He didn't have the burst that he had at the beginning of those games. So that's an interesting tool in the toolkit, though, of how to contain the Warriors, and it's something that Alvin Gentry saw firsthand.
Key questions for this team this year that are going to, if these have a positive answer, they're going to get to where they want, which is going to mean winning the championship. Or if it doesn't work out as well, then we could see them, you know, losing in the second round or something.
Mm-hmm. Wait, you're supposed to, am I supposed to come up with a key question, or are you asking me?
I didn't actually ask you a question. I did one of those things where I just made a statement and expected you to respond. But yeah, I mean, maybe another way.
What is this, Jeopardy? I'm supposed to go, what are the Warriors?
Yeah, what are the variables that, you know, you could say some things are pretty consistent. You know, Steph's going to be good. You know, that Clay's going to be good. Like, kind of what are the question marks that are going to determine whether they can get to where they want to be?
Well, I think the obvious one, it's the least fun one, is are they going to be as healthy as they were last season? I believe they were the fourth best team, give or take, last season. Now,
no injuries so far, though, which is encouraging.
I mean, other than Steve Kerr. But I think they can withstand any injury for a period of time other than to Steph Curry and Draymond Green. Like those two are the most important players on the team. Anyone else, they could scramble and come up with a replacement or a different look. Those two are integral. So keeping those guys healthy, whether they're healthy, that's going to be a big determinant as far as whether this team will win a championship. And, you know, I there's no guarantees, as we talked about before, but they invest a tremendous amount in keeping this team healthy. They overhauled their training staff despite the success last year. It essentially went to Atlanta and became the Hawks training staff, and they've brought in these Australian sports scientists run by a man by the name of Lachlan Penfold, which doesn't sound like a real name. It sounds like a Sherlock Holmes character, but they're trapped.
It sounds like one of like the lords on Braveheart who betrayed William Wallace for estates in Northern England.
Oh yeah. That turncoat, that guy, Lachlan. I mean, that with a fancy pants name like that, he clearly was a British sympathizer. I think that was obvious. But anyway, they're monitoring more of their practices. They have this little device that charts that charts a lot of body function. That's almost in a mini hoodie of their practice uniform, the one with the Yotes yogurt design on it now. And so they're taking those out at the end of practice. I don't know what information they're getting and how actionable that info is, but they're investing even more into the technology of keeping people healthy. I asked Andrew Bogut about it, and he just grumpily said that it was an iPod, which is very true to form. But they're ramping up their efforts to keep people healthier. Of course, that guarantees nothing, but that does, I think, increase your probability in the probabilistic outcome of injury. And so they could easily repeat the health of last year. They could certainly do that. I think it's funny that we approach injury in this way where we act as though if you were healthy one year, you're going to be hurt the next. And if you're hurt one year, you're going to be healthy the next. Generally, that's not how injury works. It's not like with Grant Hill in his prime, sadly, that, his ankle is completely messed up this season. So obviously the next season he's going to be the picture of health.
Yeah, I think that's a question for sure, the health. But they do benefit from the fact that they have a lot of guys who never get hurt. Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and Harrison Barnes, and Steph Curry for the last 3 years as well. Those guys just don't miss games.
Draymond's the one I would worry about most. I hope I'm not jinxing anything, but just defensive players tend to wear down. And that expansion of energy. Is expansion a word? I might have invented.
Expenditure.
Yeah, I think I invented a word right there. The expenditure of energy, it's just hard. We see guys like Avery Bradley and Patrick Beverley, the shorter defenders, they tend to get hurt. So that's the one I would worry about.
Yeah, that's Bogut is always a little bit of a question mark, but I don't think they're counting on him nearly as much as you might have said around this time last year. And Iguodala, he'll miss some games, I think, for maintenance. But other than that one hamstring injury, he's been fine. He'll always have, like, some issues with his knees usually during the course of the year. The big question for me is the defense going to be as good? We touched on that already with kind of the motivation.
I don't think it will be.
I mean, this was the number one defense by, I think, like 2 points per 100 possessions or so last year. And certainly throughout most of the year, it was much better than that, even, I think. So they were can they get back to that level at least by playoff time? That's how they won the 67 games last year, was because of that defense.
Yeah, I think in the playoffs you will see that defense ramp up, but I don't think you'll see the same level of effort. So I expect the defense to get worse, and I expect the offense to get better. And the offense does, at least in the preseason, look smooth as far as what they're running, and they are reaching that level where a lot of things are second nature. So I expect that attack will be even more fun to watch.
Best realistic case. When I say realistic, that means non-catastrophic injuries, just sort of normal injuries that you might expect throughout a course of the year. I would say obviously winning the championship, but what do you think is the best possible record they could have if everything goes right?
They could win two championships this year. They could win 70 games.
Right.
They want to kill that noise. And when I've talked to them about it, there's a lot of focus on how the schedule is brutal from the early outset. So just see us get through this schedule, and then maybe we can talk about something crazy like that. I don't think anybody in the organization expects to win 70 games. I think the expectation is that they're going to not win as many games because they don't need to prove that to themselves. But it's in the realm of possibility if as many people improve as could potentially improve. I wouldn't dismiss it, considering, hey, they weren't far from doing that last season.
Yeah, and they're not. It's not like it would be historically unprecedented for a team to win one championship and come back better in the regular season next year. Like that was, you could say that it, maybe in some ways this team last year was analogous to what the 91 Bulls did, kind of breaking through with a young team. And if you just look at these are the ages of these guys, you know, they could get better. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it means that 92 Bulls team won 67 after they won 61 the year before, and maybe they could take another bit of a step up. I mean, obviously, when you win 67, you got to kind of project them to regress a little bit. What about the worst realistic scenario?
The worst realistic scenario outside of the injury stuff that we've talked about is Harrison Barnes being impacted by these contract talks and going completely in the tank as they try to get his confidence and they try to play him more. And it just becomes an issue on the team. And also, perhaps the team just isn't as copacetic because it is a team that relies on a lot of people sacrificing for each other, which sounds like a cliche, but it's true. And you want to keep Andre Iguodala happy, and you want to keep him believing in his role. I could see a negative scenario where after winning finals MVP, disease of Moore, he thinks that he should start. He thinks that he's not getting his due, and it becomes cancerous in the locker room. I don't think that will happen, but that's something, if I'm thinking of bad, worst-case scenario, something like that could afflict them and maybe knock them down to a Mark Jackson level win total.
It would be hard for me to imagine them winning less than like 57 games with this team unless Steph or Draymond miss very significant time.
I think so. I think it's hard to see them going back to the Mark Jackson days. I was reading something recently. I don't know if I can pull it up from right after they – a lot of the coverage after Jackson was fired is retroactively hilarious. It's really
– Oh, the – like, oh, my gosh, like, I can't believe they let go of this guy. You haven't seen this type of winning in so long. How can you get rid of him?
Yeah, that type of thing, and that they're not capable of winning any more than they won, that they have essentially topped out at this win total. That was the belief among a lot of people in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah, and I think we don't give organizations enough credit for knowing when it's not working with the coach, because it's not just performance. We won X number of games. We had this level of defense. How can you let this guy go? You know, they're in practice every day. They see what he's doing. They know, I think, much better than anyone on the outside can, how much of this is our players, how much of this is our coach. Can you reasonably say, yeah, we had the number three defense. Here are the things that Mark Jackson is doing in practice to make that happen, or maybe he's not doing anything. And most of these teams that are good, that have fired a coach, that people have sort of decried over the last 5 years, other than the Nuggets.
That was the first team that came to mind.
Yeah, other than them, though, I mean, the Clippers, the Grizzlies, you know, I think I'm missing, obviously, the Warriors. I'm missing another one. When they moved on from their coach, they really, I think, improved, and it was the right decision.
And also, these organizations know more about their situation than we know. When coaches get fired, it might not necessarily just be about the performance. It could be about so many different issues. I know of some in terms of the Grizzlies that aren't exactly out there publicly. And so there's just so much beyond the TV show of the games that we all see that could potentially influence such a decision. I'm looking at this blast from the past from Zach Lowe's column, and he's talking – these aren't his opinions. He's talking about what the conventional wisdom was written back right after Jackson is fired. Where you come down on Jackson probably has something to do with your take on the roster. There is a lot of skepticism. There's a link that leads to that skepticism. That any coach could have done much better than 51 wins and a first-round exit in the crazy West. The Warriors only have one All-Star in Curry. The Thunder, Clippers, and Blazers all have two, and the Spurs are the Spurs. Perhaps Golden State is really just a mediocrity within this conference. That even might have been the conventional wisdom at that particular time.
Well, yeah, nobody was picking them even to be a top four seed in the West last year, so it's pretty remarkable what they were able to do. So this is my last question here. Actually, no, I got two more. But this one I think is really interesting. This is not in the outline, so I'm going to have to ask you to ad-lib here.
Oh, no.
But who are the matchups that they who are the teams they match up well against in the West playoffs, and who might they be a little worried about?
That's a great question. I think they'll always be worried about the Spurs, just because...
Sure. They got those two great defensive players on the wing. Yeah. That's the biggest thing.
Danny Green... Oh, Danny Green is so damn good defensively. But Danny Green and Kawhi, where everybody knows how great he is defensively, throwing Kawhi on Clay, Danny Green on Curry, and that'll just always be the team that they fear a little bit as Big Brother, perhaps, just because of Kerr's history with that team, because the Spurs were the only team to win a season series against the Warriors last year. I know the Warriors were going to have this just extensive film session of that game if they were to play the Spurs. As an aside, this idea that they got lucky in not having to face the Clippers or the Spurs, as Doc Rivers said, they did not care about facing the Clippers. What Klay Thompson said...
And rightfully so.
What Klay Thompson said about wanting to play the Clippers and having wanted to play the Clippers, but they didn't handle their business, he is not lying. They would have been totally comfortable and totally happy to play the Clippers. The Spurs, on the other hand, they were happy to avoid the Spurs. I remember watching them watch that game against the Pelicans, that last game of the year, because I think the Warriors were playing later that night, and I remember watching Steph Curry yell, "Miss it! Miss it!" on certain Spurs shots. So they were, you know, they would have been confident about their chances against the Spurs, but that was definitely a team they were happy to have avoided. So I think the list begins and ends with the Spurs, and a team I've been down on a little bit, the Oklahoma City Thunder, you've been bigger on them than I have. Just reading a lot of the quotes coming from the players this preseason, it sounds a little bit like what you heard from the Warriors in terms of praising the better ball movement. So I wonder if that's a team I've underrated that could be a bigger threat than I realized.
Yeah, and I think I totally agree with you. The Spurs is a rough matchup. I would love to see if they had the balls to use the Draymond at center lineup against the Spurs starting lineup. That would be awesome.
That would be a lot of fun
to see that. To see that strategic matchup, to just, you know, put Draymond on LaMarcus Aldridge, Barnes would just be on Tim Duncan, and all right, Tim, you want to beat us on post-ups, you know, as what should probably be the third or fourth option, go ahead. And now, you know, Tim Duncan has to guard someone at the three-point line. He's got to get out on Steph Curry 35 feet from the basket.
I mean, I was watching.
Amazing to see.
I was watching, too, and this goes back to why I'm not sure if the Spurs made the right move for challenging the Warriors. I was watching some Portland Golden State from last year, and man, did Steph kill LaMarcus on those pick and rolls. I mean, some of that is Lillard not being good defensively, but it felt like Lillard gets all the blame in those situations, and Curry is really comfortable torching him, very comfortable. So
we'll see. I still think it's going to work out pretty well for them. I worry a little bit about their lack of depth on the wing. And obviously Tony Parker too is another one. I mean, that's kind of the problem, because the Spurs, if you're going to put Green on Curry and then you're going to put Kawhi on Clay, now you've got Tony Parker guarding Harrison Barnes. And I think Harrison Barnes killed him. You know,
this is the nightmare scenario. We're talking about what could go wrong. Potentially Harrison is in a tailspin contract stuff, who knows what else, and that actually works as a strategy, and hiding Parker there is effective. I think that's the nightmare scenario.
Yeah, and I don't think Iguodala can that's the one place where Barnes is better than Iguodala is in sort of torching whoever that, you know, the hider is. Oklahoma City is a concern too, because I don't think that they, for all the athletes they have on the wing, they have never ever succeeded in stopping Durant.
Nope.
Westbrook is too fast and too athletic for Curry.
I will say this, and this might be something the ball movement fixes and makes them truly dangerous. Westbrook was awful against them last year. Awful. Offensively. With Curry guarding him for a lot of the time. And I think a lot of that was because it was one-on-five, just try to beat this defense in the way Westbrook wants to challenge that defense, and that is not effective. So I think the fear, if you're looking at that matchup, is that they've had Westbrook pretty contained, and I would have been really confident even if the Thunder were fully healthy last season and the Warriors beating them for that reason, despite Durant continually torching the Warriors. But I would maybe fear from a Warriors perspective that the Billy Donovan offense optimizes Westbrook and that less of Westbrook is more of Westbrook, and that's what would allow them to triumph over Golden State.
Yeah, and the small lineup is not nearly as big of a concern for Oklahoma City. They can go with Ibaka and Durant at the 4 and 5, which is pretty tough to stop as well. The Clippers, you still think the Warriors match up pretty well with them, I take it?
Yeah, I expect the Clippers to take a little bit of a step back next season. I think it's hard to know. You've talked about this on your podcast. We don't know when Chris Paul's skills erode. We don't know. But this might be the first year of that. And even if the bench is better than last season's bench, that might not be seen a whole lot. And Draymond Green so far has done a fantastic job of guarding Blake Griffin. So matchup-wise, I like that for Golden State a lot better than I like it for the Clippers.
Yeah, I think DeAndre Jordan has historically had some decent success against the Warriors when he's locked in.
Well, he's going against the team with no center. He's done pretty well. He did.
Yeah, even Bogut, though, I think doesn't quite have the athleticism to keep up with him. Who else am I missing? What about Houston? I think they're still good against Houston. They match up okay against Houston still. You know, I don't think that that's another one of those teams where maybe they dump Ty Lawson and put in Beverly, but I don't think ultimately when it comes down to it that Houston is going to be able to score well enough against the Warriors.
As an aside, I will preface this by saying I love Houston's roster this year.
Oh, and they have a massive coaching advantage against Houston too.
I would say that. And I would preface this by saying that I love Houston's roster, and I'm a fan of what they're doing with their team in general. But I found it absurd in the conversation about luck that we're talking about, they went against an injured point guard every series and Curry didn't have to go against Patrick Beverley. I don't know what it is with Patrick Beverley. I like him. I'm a fan of him. He's a very nice person to talk to from a media perspective. He was awful last season. He was not good and got torched when he went against the Warriors. That might be because he was banged up over the course of the year. But the idea that this is something that turns the series, or this is the reason why the Warriors caught an advantage in that particular series, I find to be an absurdity.
Yeah, and Howard cannot really post up against them anymore. Terrence Jones has never really played well against the Warriors at all. Demo is not going to be able to defend well enough to play at the four. I think one reason I might think that Houston could get
offensive rebounding.
That's what I was going to say. If Houston can get to the point where either someone like Sam Dekker or KJ McDaniels develops into a viable small ball four option, and then Houston can start doing all the same kind of switching stuff that the Warriors do around Dwight Howard, that might be a way for them to match up as best as possible. Because I don't think that they're power forwards, Houston, are going to be good enough. And Ty Lawson's a decent player, but I don't think he tilts the balance.
They will have the athletic advantage over the Warriors. The Rockets are a more athletic team, for whatever that's worth, and that can sometimes disrupt a high IQ team. We certainly saw that with the Thunder against the Spurs in that playoff series.
Harden also actually had a really nasty sprained ankle over the summer, apparently. I don't think he's going to be as good this year as he was last year.
He sprained his ankle jamming his foot into some Nikes when he was supposed to be repping. No, I'm just joking. That was a big topic of debate. Apparently, he had to be wearing Nike until the very end of his contract. Does this mean that I'm totally out to lunch? I didn't even know that about James Harden. I had no idea.
I only saw it recently, actually, in the last couple of days. I think it has kind of been underpublicized. It just happened like working out or something.
Huh.
During the summer, it wasn't like, so maybe that's why we didn't know about it. But I think, you know, he's not someone that I think of as like some kind of a workout warrior. I think he's getting past his pure athletic prime already. So I think it's, and he just was awesome last year. But ultimately, I think if it really, even if you say the personnel is equal with Houston, I just don't think that the coaching that over the course of a series that Kevin McHale can quite get them defending at the level that they need to be and that he can make the adjustments the way this fantastic Warriors coaching staff has been able to.
Yeah, I would agree with that. At the same time, I respect Houston, and I see them as a legitimate threat in the way that I might not see some other teams in the West.
That's not to say it's impossible Houston beats them or it's impossible the Clippers beat them. I mean, we'll
like I would say this. I would see Houston as more of a threat than the Clippers.
Okay. Yeah, maybe that's fair, especially if Paul were to take a little bit of a step back. Yeah, I just don't think that the Clippers, they did as well as they could possibly over this offseason. But yeah, I just don't see a way that their defense gets quite to where it needs to be to where they're ever going to stop the Warriors. I don't see the Warriors ever being in a situation where they're going to struggle to score against that team.
I agree.
All right, so the last question that I've been asking everyone that seems to have an obvious answer, but since you are a contrarian, I will ask you and see if you follow suit in this case. How good is this team's ownership and front office, and what grade would you give them since the current regime came into power? I guess it would be since 2010 when Lakeham bought the team.
I would have to give it an A, despite how I think hiring Mark Jackson at the time they did was a mistake that, in retrospect, they say was important and built the foundation. But I don't necessarily think that was. That was such a poisonous situation with so much potential to make things.
Was it the first 2 years, though? Well, actually, I'll tell you what. If you think he wasn't a good coach, it actually worked out great that they had him that first year, because then they kept their draft pick and they got Harrison Barnes.
So, yeah, it was all a ploy. It was all planned.
But I will say this, though. They deserve credit for tanking.
Yeah.
Deserve credit for doing that. Yeah. Joe Lacob got his ass booed like all the way up to like San Mateo or down to San Mateo. Geographic reference fail. In any event, he got booed like crazy, and he took it and dealt with it because they traded away the popular Monte Ellis, and they had made a playoff guarantee at the start of the year, and they did not come anywhere close, and they kept their draft pick, and they have Harrison Barnes. And I don't think that they win the championship without Harrison Barnes.
That tank job, as awful as it was, as much as it convinced me that the NBA needed to do something about this. I mean, it was, as a viewing experience, a terrible, terrible slog, and I hated it, but I supported it as a decision, and it was really one of the first times that this franchise in particular, a very short-sighted franchise, a franchise that likes shiny objects and tries to placate fans with a fun brand of basketball as opposed to a winning brand of basketball, finally they were making a decision that was pound-wise, you know, as they say, like pound-wise, penny-foolish, or what's the opposite of that? I'm trying to remember.
Penny-wise, pound-foolish.
They were being pound-wise. They were saying that we are going to not entertain fans because we're trying to have some broader goals here. And I thought in that way, as deplorable as some people find tanking, as dishonorable as it is, it was a sign of maturity for the organization.
Yeah, the only thing that they've done, I think, that you can look back at as being objectively terrible was amnestying Charlie Bell rather than Biedrance in the attempt to try and sign DeAndre Jordan, who was probably going to get matched anyway. And granted, you know, that contract they were trying to sign DeAndre Jordan to would have been a good contract,
true,
you know, for $11 million a year.
That's how Bob Myers defends that particular
situation. Right, but, all right, so if you think you need a new center, how about you amnesty the old center that you need to replace? But anyway, we've talked about that many times before on this podcast. I mean, can you think of anything else you would point to over the last 5 years that hasn't been a good idea?
I'm surprised you didn't say paying Barbosa $2 million is the worst decision in the history of decisions.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would have rather have saved the mini mid-level for something else, maybe something you can pick up during the course of the year, although they do have the tax concern.
I guess you could say with the Barnes draft pick, you could have gotten somebody else. You could have potentially gotten Andre Drummond, for instance. So if you were quibbling with that, you could point to that particular decision.
Yeah. Yeah, that certainly was not quite a value maximization. But that said, I mean, I think that they win that championship. They're more likely to win that championship with Barnes than with Andre Drummond.
It's a really good organization, and I guess they lucked out. They lucked out in a way that people wouldn't necessarily realize, because they've gotten Kirk Lacob, son of the owner, is involved in the organization, and I think we can say, without sounding too worshipful of power for power's sake, that he's a smart guy, and that that's a roll of the dice.
Yeah, they could have lost the, like, Dan Carlin
genetic
loss, right?
The dice. Like, no, that's the way he talks. How does he talk? Temujin.
Yeah. yeah, anyway, for those who are enormous fans of the Hardcore History Mongols series, you'll know what we're talking about, which is, you know, 1% of my listeners. But yeah, they've done a great job, and, you know, having a guy like that in the organization who has done well, they have this sort of, you know, chorus of voices and are able to arrive at the right decisions. That, you know, not making the love trade was a zag that most people, you and I included, thought was a really bad decision. Worked out great, obviously, far superior to anything you could have imagined, even if they had gotten him. So yeah, it's really, and just even the little things, they always get the little things, right? Like, they extracted their pound of flesh from Clay by having him just sign a hard, you know, something for the projected max instead of a true max that would get filled in later. Save a few million bucks that way. Draymond Green, absolutely a max player, signs for $12 million less over the course of 5 years than he could add. You save some money there. Both of those guys, you're going to save money now in 2017 as well. The Curry extension, obviously the thing that basically made all this possible. All the gyrations that they did to get Andre Iguodala, trading away two unprotected first-round picks to Utah. Really a big risk.
And
going to end up
one,
not costing them at all.
One where there was some potential arbitrage there, because those picks look more tempting when they're unprotected. So a lot of people won't do that because there's the potential disaster scenario where you're bad and you need them. But it's an interesting way to see how you can get value for things. If you know you're going to be great, if you believe you're going to be great, then you can have those picks look more valuable than they are by taking the protections off. So I think that was a good move, and a move that they absolutely needed to do, or that deal wouldn't have gotten across the finish line.
Yeah, and so they dumped all those bad contracts, and you know, there's really, and even just getting rid of David Lee and managing to turn him into Jason Thompson while giving up nothing more than a swap rights with Oklahoma City. So it only goes to Philly if, because Philly had Oklahoma City's pick.
I mean, Bob Byers is on fire right now.
The only way they lose anything is if Oklahoma City finishes with a better record than the Warriors, then they get knocked back to Oklahoma City's pick. And they, so that it's really been impressive. And ownership is willing to fork over for the luxury tax this year, it looks like, too, which a lot of people had wondered about.
Yeah, Bob Myers is on fire right now. Maybe Harrison Barnes will be his Waterloo. I don't know, but it's hard to criticize. And that back end of the NBA is very important. The stuff that people can't see does a whole lot to inform the value of what people do see. And, you know, look at where Steph Curry's career was going before the ownership changed. You know, nobody would have thought he'd be a Hall of Famer, let alone what he's become, which is somebody who's going to have a shot at being the best player in the league. That's an incredible turnaround, and I don't think it happens without the ownership change.
All right, well, we have gone on for far too long here with NBA back-end expert Ethan Strauss. You got anything to plug? You got that really nice Jerry West Q&A, which I enjoyed. It was just a straight Q&A format. You sat down with him for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That was really good. What else should we be looking for with you?
I guess I wrote an article recently on the neurological/physical training that Steph Curry does, and it's interesting to me in terms of what the future of athletic training is. He uses the FitLite trainer, which has a lot of flash.
Maybe that's what I need, so I can talk and look stuff up while doing my podcast at the same time.
Yeah, I think that would help with the multitasking. So I came out with that article. I enjoyed the podcast that we just did. We involved this guy named Waz in our weekend podcast. We called.
He's fantastic, by the way.
He's just, that guy's just charismatic, man.
How did you guys even find him? Like, who is he?
He kind of found us, and we just kept rolling with it. He just sort of was a listener to what we do, and Jade, because Jade is a master of chaos who records people without telling them, just sort of threw him into the mix, and it totally worked out. So recorded a Waz pod, and also a straight-up newser of Clay Thompson napalming the Clippers and Doc Rivers that happened on Friday.
Oh, man. I do I'm enjoying every bit of this Warriors title defense so far, with just the level of arrogance that they're showing while at the same time being disrespected. I think it's going to be a wonderful combination. Like the Steph high-fiving Iguodala before his shot even went in the other night was unbelievable. And so I think, despite the fact that we worry a little bit about their motivation and that we worry a little bit about the defense staying at the level that it was, I think this still does have the potential to be, you know, where they could be even better than last year due to that combination of being disrespected and the confidence that they have in themselves.
People didn't notice, but Steph got the closest I've ever seen him to legit mean when asked about Ty Lawson's comments about him chilling on defense. He was not.
Well, and there was the Harden MVP comments, too.
That one was a little more muted just because I was there for that, and I don't think he meant it. I don't think he meant it to be adversarial in any way. He tried to dilute it by saying we all have things to get us motivated. And then when he said it doesn't change the result, he did this funny thing where I didn't notice until seeing the video clip of it, but he kind of bit his lip a little bit, like he didn't mean for that to seep out. Like he didn't mean to say what he just said. With Ty Lawson, it was different. It was just, that's funny to me. That's funny to me in the most condescending tone. That, come on, Ty Lawson, you don't get to talk. You know,
it's really actually being there. I've only really been in media for 2 years now, to where I've actually been interviewing athletes, or more often just being there while they are being interviewed, with, because I don't really ask those sorts of questions. This guy said this. What's your reaction? But when it's amazing to me that athletes don't flub up and get these massive soundbite headlines more often. Think of just how difficult that is, right? You're sitting there in front of a bunch of cameras. You're engaged in one of the most public things that you can possibly.
Oh, it's not difficult. You just try.
Well, no. Well, listen.
Ask me a question. I'll do it. Just ask.
All right. Now, let me finish my point first.
No. This is my podcast. This is not your podcast.
The usual crap about, oh, hey, is this team like really feeling confident now? Yeah, all right, obviously that's ridiculously easy to respond to. But if someone comes up to you and says, James Harden said this, what is your reaction? You haven't, number one, you don't know whether he actually said that or not. You have to take the guy's word for it. You haven't read what he actually said. You're finding out about it for the first time in front of a bunch of cameras. So first of all, you have to determine, what is my real reaction to this? And his real reaction to this was probably, oh, this is BS. And then you have to say, oh, wait a minute, what would the consequences be if I actually say what I really think here? I better not say that. And having to do all that within the course of like 2 seconds. I mean, when he got asked that, you could see him just sort of think for like 10 seconds as the wheels turned, to like, all right, I guess I got to answer this. How can I avoid really like having something negative about myself get out there? It's a difficult job. I think it really is, you know?
No, I don't think it is. I think these guys are pretty calculating. I think I'm not accusing him of lying in this particular instance, but 90% of the time where they ask what happened, they actually know what happened because all their family members and friends tell them about all this stuff. So that gives them plausible deniability, though, when they say what happened, what was said, because they can always say, oh, I didn't know the context. And it's easy. It's easy to just give a boring, flat voice answer. It's just I think it's easy. It's really, what's hard is if you want to be honest. If you're an honest person who believes in honesty, then it's difficult. But if you have no problem just dismissing and deflecting questions in the way Tim Duncan might, just, well, I don't know exactly what he said, but Harden's a great player, he's a great competitor, and you know, he's somebody I love playing against. Like, you can
well,
just say that.
It's easy for you to do that, though, because this isn't your livelihood. You're not wrapped up in, I mean, in reality, like how much money these people make is based in large part upon what other people think of them, especially from an endorsement standpoint. So like you don't have anything on the line, and you don't have any real emotional reaction to this that you have to hide, because this, a lot of times this is personal stuff.
That's a great point, because Clay certainly had a legit, genuine emotional reaction to the Doc Rivers stuff, but I also think that was good for him and how he's perceived. And the Warriors PR, they were kind of, I wouldn't say freaking out, but they didn't like that happened. And I was saying to them, look, I don't think this is a bad thing. I think this is fun. This is, people don't want sports just to be sports. They like the soap opera element, and they're not wrong to do it. I remember in the early days of the Clippers Warriors rivalry, and somebody asked him if it was a rivalry, and Steph said no. And then after we were done, he was saying, why does it have to be a rivalry? Why do people need this to be a rivalry? And I said to him, well, just why is anything anything? You know, like, why are people interested in a sphere flying at a ring? Of course, that goes over well. But more to the point, people like to dress up their sports in this, and it makes it far more entertaining. And the whole idea behind all of this is it's entertainment. This is television. So I do think that stuff, as silly as it is and as much of a detour as it can be, it's fun, man. And it was fun when Klay Thompson said what he said.
Yeah, if you are working for a team in that media relations capacity, you're really, anything that's interesting is almost a downside, right? I mean, your job is essentially to make sure all coverage is kind of blasé.
It's a downside if you feel like you have to put out every fire and you regard certain things as fires.
Yeah, I was getting to that exact point. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But I'm interrupting you because I'm rude.
Well, but you're going to make it better than I am, so please continue.
Oh, no. I think there's a bit of a mission creep where if your orientation is to make things as antiseptic as possible, then you're going to regard everything as a threat. Not everything is a threat. Certain things help your team get out in the headlines and become a national brand in the way that the Spurs have never been. And I'm sure the Spurs are happy with the level of success that they had. But at the same time, they're not going to be as remembered, perhaps, or more, you know, or as popular as they could be than if they showed a little personality and had some of these soap opera situations and back and forth that other teams have.
All right, I tried to do the outro before, but obviously we continue to talk because there's a lot of good stuff to talk about. But maybe we can save that for another podcast. Thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
I love coming by. Thanks so much for having me, Nate.
All right. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Nate Duncan NBA. Ethan, I don't think he said, is Sherwood Strauss.
Mm-hmm.
And our season preview series, this is the latest in a long line. I think we're up to 12 now. I did the Spurs yesterday with Dan McCarney. That was a good one. Chris Vernon on the Grizzlies was excellent. He had some really interesting stuff to say about Mike Conley free agency and Marcus Gasol free agency. Chris Haynes was really good on the Tristan Thompson situation. That all still applies, even though that was about 3-4 days ago. So, yeah, listen to as many as you find interesting. We're going to hopefully get all 30 teams in before the year starts. Also, you can support the podcast by going to our sponsors, DraftKings, which Ethan can approve of since they also sponsor ESPN. Use the cap space code, which Ethan cannot approve of because that's taking away from ESPN's advertising. And also the code on SeatGeek cap space as well. That'll give you $20 off your first purchase. So anyway, for Ethan, I am Nate, and we'll talk to you all next time.
See you, everybody.